This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Our guest in this portion of the program spent 9 years as a psychologist in the Navy. In 2004, she was deployed to Iraq, where she served for nearly 8 months in Al-Anbar province. When she deployed, she left behind her not-yet-two-year-old twins, Brian and Megan, and their father, her husband, who had served 11 years in the Marine Corps. When Dr. Heidi Squirecraft came home, she thought she'd want to forget her time in Iraq. She changed her mind. She wanted to remember. Dr. Craft has written a memoir about her service in Iraq, Rule Number 2, Lessons I Learned in a Combat Hospital. The title, Rule Number 2, was inspired by the television show MASH. There are two rules of war. Rule number one is that young men die. Rule number two is that doctors can't change rule number one. No longer on active duty, Dr. Craft is currently a practicing clinician treating patients suffering from combat trauma. She is the deputy coordinator for the U.S. Navy Combat Stress Control Program. Listeners, I invite your phone calls for our guest, Dr. Heidi Squirecraft. Your questions and comments are invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Craft's book, Rule Number 2, Lessons I Learned in a Combat Hospital, is published by Little Brown, and 10% of the royalties she receives from sales of the book will be donated to the Injured Marine Semper Fi Fund. For more information about our guest and the book, you may want to visit the website RuleNumber2.com. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Dr. Craft, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
When and how did you realize you wanted to remember?
Well, I think it probably took about 3 or 4 months after returning home.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I felt very disconnected from my patients at home, my family, my friends. Everyone told me I was different, and I felt all wrong. Sort of everything was backwards. Things that should be sad were not sad, and vice versa. And as a clinician, I guess it's pretty easy to recognize these symptoms, but not as easy to do something about it. So when I finally made that decision for myself, for my family, that I needed to get some help, it was about that same time that I decided to start writing. And this is an established form of trauma therapy. It was a variety of situational events that led to that, but I started writing about some of the more memorable moments from my experience. And as I wrote, it became easier and it became more important to me to make sure that my children had a record of this.
Yeah. It seems that this book serves a number of purposes. First of all, it is a memoir for your children, and as you mentioned, it was therapeutic for you. But also, it honors those who serve and those who you served with.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's one of the things, as I began to remember and to sort of search back into those memories that had been numbed and repressed, I was astonished by some of the things that I witnessed, some of the people that touched my life and whom I have the honor to care for and to serve with.
Yeah. Well, here, would you tell us about Corporal Jason Dunham?
Absolutely. Of course, the most memorable and extraordinary story. Corporal Dunham entered our surgical company very soon after we had arrived in Iraq as one of many, many casualties that came in that day. And our surgical companies were very, very limited mobile field hospitals. Our whole purpose was stabilization and transport. So we defined a mass casualty as anything that overwhelmed our capacity in the operating rooms. That day was a mass casualty. We had 14 patients come in the door, and he was one of them. When that happens, we move into a plan where everybody has a role. And my role was to sort of wander around and check in on our people and on the patients and provide any needed assistance. Corporal Dunham had been triaged immediately as being expectant, which is a term not used in American medicine. Very often we save it for combat medicine in limited situations like this. He showed no meaningful brain activity and was expected to die. There was nothing that could be done for him in that austere environment. This is difficult for American doctors to deal with, but what we do in this situation is move those patients to a place where they can receive support and fluids and medication in those last final moments. So I happened to be in the expectant room when Corporal Dunham was there and sat down with some of the other folks that were there and held his hand and planned to be with him as he died. The extraordinary thing about this story is that he did not die. He started squeezing my hand. And at one point, I think I found myself as a medical provider thinking this could just be a reflex. He's got a brain injury. But he kept doing it. So I asked him to squeeze on command. I said, if you can hear me, I need you to squeeze right now. And he did. So clearly, his status had changed. It was really quite a medical miracle. And we, of course, moved him to the ICU and immediately got him on the helicopter and on his way to the next level of care. He did get all the way home to Bethesda, where his parents were waiting. And unfortunately, his situation deteriorated in transport, and he was never able to regain consciousness. His parents made the decision to let him go once he was home with them. The extraordinary part of the story, well, there are two. One is that we didn't know what he had done to sustain his injury. Later we learned he had thrown himself on a grenade to save the two Marines that were with him. He was nominated for and subsequently awarded the Medal of Honor for that act. The other extraordinary thing was that a reporter had been embedded with his unit, had seen the whole thing happen, had written a story about it in the Wall Street Journal, and later a book, which is called A Gift of Valor. In doing the interviews for the book, he came through our hospital and met us and learned that Corporal Dunham had been fighting so hard to stay alive and responding to our voice. And in learning that story from us, then later shared our experiences with the corporal's mother, who had told him that her greatest fear was that no one was holding her son's hand.
Mm.
So because of this extraordinary connection and interesting circumstances, I was able to be in contact with his parents. They contacted me to thank me for being there with their son. And we now have quite an amazing friendship. So really kind of full circle in an extraordinary way.
And what's so far in your life, what's your proudest day been?
I think that the moment that I was with them at the White House, when the president awarded that Medal of Honor to them posthumously for his act, they had asked me to be one of a very few people that they invited to be with them during that moment. I think it stands alone as the proudest day of my life.
Mm. What led you to enlist?
My father's a career submarine officer in the Navy, retired. And he had told me all along, the Naval Academy is the way to go, and I said, no way. And then the military medical school is the way to go, and I said, no way. I really fought it. And then about halfway through my internship, actually, I had been a private pilot. I was flying for fun, dating a guy that was going through Navy flight school at the time. And he learned that the Navy has such things as flight psychologists that care for the aviation fleet and get the chance to fly in these really amazing aircraft. So I really switched careers midstream and left what I had planned to be a postdoc fellowship in behavioral medicine and joined the Navy. And no regrets.
Yeah.
It's an amazing experience.
Yeah. Proud papa, no doubt.
Very much so.
Yeah.
He laughed the whole way to come and do my enlistment, or my officer's oath.
Yeah. Now, your dad served in Korea and Vietnam, but you write early in the book, rule number two, he never spoke of it.
He doesn't, no. He's opened up a little bit more about it to me since my experience.
Yeah.
And I think as I was getting ready to go and as we were making our plans, there was a moment where he came to me and he said, what is your wish for if something happens out there? What is your wish? And I had already talked to my husband about it, but the way he looked at me, there was this understanding in his eyes where I knew that he really got it and that he had been through all this before.
Yeah. And what did your husband say to you, Mike, who had served in the Marine Corps for, I believe, 11 years?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. What did the two of you talk about once you knew you were going?
You know, we knew this was a real possibility. The only surprise here was the timing. We expected me to go the next year when the East Coast Marines went. I was pulled by myself to support the West Coast Marines, and that was the shocking timing, sort of just the real short turnaround. But he told me that he was very proud of me, that there were people that needed me more than they did right now, that they would be fine, that he wanted me to go and take care of his brother and sister Marines. That's what he knew I was meant to do. So there was no real emotional response. We made our plans. We got things in order, and I knew he was very supportive of this. It was why I wore the uniform.
When you learned you were being deployed, what were your first thoughts? It was a shock, you said.
It was a shock, only because, as I said, I think I was very prepared to be called the next year when the rotation happened to the East Coast Hospital. I was also shocked that they were only giving me 10 days notice to get ready to go. It was a real quick turnaround. But interestingly, I think it was a strange sort of, after the initial shock, it was a strange sort of peace. I knew that I was one of the right people to be sent, that I was able to do this job. I knew that my children had a very loving and wonderfully capable father. I knew that my parents were going to make a huge sacrifice and come and stay with him so that to be able to help him. And so there was nothing really to worry about. I felt very peaceful.
Yeah. I imagine, though, just be really, really tough to leave those kids.
Of course.
Even though, you know, they're in great hands.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I think the moment I remember it really hitting me was as I walked through security and had to physically leave them to get on the plane. I was crying as I walked through security. I remember that sort of being a real emotional moment of sort of being hit by a ton of bricks, the gravity of actually physically walking away.
Yeah.
I think that's when it hit me.
How many active duty military personnel have children?
Oh, my goodness, I don't know. It's got to be a large percentage. I've never looked at that number. I mean, I know we have certainly a lot that are very young, so haven't had the chance to have children yet, but we also have a lot of young parents. So I would imagine it's a majority.
Yeah. Do you think there's adequate attention paid to the needs of military families in that regard?
I think we're getting there. I know that there's been a real shift in focus and an understanding of the need to care for the children and spouses of combat veterans, that we know that we probably didn't pay attention enough in past conflicts. So there is a lot of new programming that's ramping up, that's going to, and already is, really focusing on this factor and trying to keep families in the focus.
This is something that I've wondered about, and I've never had the opportunity to ask this. Can a military couple with children be deployed at the same time?
They can. They can, and they are. Two active duty people with children have what's called a family deployment plan, and they have to document what their plan will be, where their children will go should they both be deployed.
Wow. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Heidi Squire-Kraft. We're talking with her about her experience as a Navy psychologist. She is a veteran of Iraq. She is the author of the memoir Rule Number 2, Lessons I Learned in a Combat Hospital. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a telephone call. We invite your questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free. We also have a toll free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. We've heard from time to time on this program and on other programs that there's a growing divide between those who serve and those of us who do not serve. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that topic.
A growing divide. I guess I'm not sure what you
mean. That maybe we're not, those of us who do not serve, who have not served, who haven't been, haven't felt the call, who haven't enlisted, that we're largely unaware of the sacrifices made, of what the life is like, what the challenges are, what the pressures are.
Right. I would have to say my own experience has not exactly been that. I think that the people I've come in contact with, civilians who have never served, have been really kind of the vast majority incredibly supportive and wanting to know, wanting to be told and understand. And to be honest, that's part of the reason I decided to publish the book.
Huh.
Jason Dunham's mother told me, she said, "I think the mothers of America don't know that there are people out there whose job it is to take care of their children when they're alone or afraid or in pain. And they need to know." And I thought, it is true that giving people the opportunity to have that unique window into this different perspective on our service people, it was a large factor in my decision to go forward with trying to get it published. I have not felt that. I have not felt a real marked difference. Now, that being said, I'm also very involved in an effort to educate our civilian providers who are caring for vets so that they try to come from a common ground. It is certainly an advantage to be a vet myself in caring for vets. That is part of what we're trying to do, help the VA as well as the DOD civilian providers to try to really understand, at least know the right things to say in their care for these folks. But that hasn't been my experience as much as maybe it has been others.
Hmm. Well, tell us about Corporal Paulson. He was very, very happy to talk with a veteran.
Right, he was. And again, Corporal Dunham's name is the only one that's real in this book. Everybody else's names have been changed.
Right.
So that is a fake name for this young man. But this was a young Marine that I met when I returned to Jacksonville. Actually, I was home from the war and was having my own trouble, sort of struggling to reconnect with patients with sort of what I called everyday problems at the time. Everything seemed very out of perspective for me. And Corporal Paulson came to me. He was a Marine who was with his family on convalescent leave, and was in a wheelchair, but with no medical reason for the paralysis of his legs. He had taken a very serious fall in Iraq from the top of a building when he was shot, but he did not sustain a spinal cord injury. Everything that his doctors could figure out was that his spinal cord was intact and that his legs should be working. So he came to my care through a sort of interesting set of circumstances, but it ended up being a really good match for us. He really liked seeing someone wearing a Marine uniform, which I was still doing. Felt like he could immediately connect with me and was able to tell me the story of the loss of his closest friend in Iraq, which he witnessed and felt very, very guilty about. It's a rare, rare thing psychologically to see what we call a true conversion disorder, and this is where there's a physiologic deficit that doesn't have an organic reason for happening. So you've heard of hysterical blindness or where a person can't see. There's nothing wrong with their eyes, but they can't see. This was sort of what the case was with him. He actually had a true conversion disorder. He couldn't move his legs, but there was no reason. So he and I worked very hard and intensely together to move through that memory of the loss of his friend and through his guilt and shame at not being the one that took those bullets. And once he had been able to reconcile that and move through it and be in it and experience it and let some part of that memory go from its grip on him, he was able to begin to move towards walking again. So it was really quite a remarkable case.
What a day that was for you, too.
Oh. One of the best days of my life as a clinician, coming around that corner and seeing him walking. He was on a walker with a PT physical therapist. And it was incredible. Yeah. He really needed to let that go in order to free himself. So, quite something.
Yeah. We have a listener who would like to speak with you, calling in from Eureka on the toll-free line, line 4. Let's go and talk with this listener. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Quite interesting program. My mind was sparked to several stories that the CBS Evening News ran. One stated, or it claimed, that the suicide rate for, I believe, both Iraqi and Afghanistan war veterans was twice the national average. And there have been quite a few other stories which seem to indicate that the returning veterans from both wars are quite underserved or not well served by the Veterans Administration and or any other medical services that they might, mental health services that they might be entitled to. Could your guest comment on those two questions, please?
Sure. My understanding about the suicide rate, and this was recent data that I saw, I'm afraid that perhaps those statistics were skewed. The Army has seen a spike in suicide rates compared to its average. That is not, however, twice the national average. It's looking more like the national average of suicide for that age group. But it is typically the military has a lower suicide rate than the standard civilian average. So it has been a spike for the Army, and the Army is aware of that. But it is not, in my understanding of the statistic, it is not twice the national average. It's still within the realm of sort of what we would see in civilian counterparts. With regard to the care, certainly, that was big news for a long time. In my experience so far, I have seen great efforts on both the VA and DOD healthcare systems to really try to address that. That certainly they're aware of that as being a serious shortcoming. And I know the VA in San Diego, their psychological health services has a new policy in place where if an OIF or OEF veteran calls asking for an appointment there, they are given that appointment within 7 days, which is really quite remarkable. So I think there is a real effort to try to address these needs. I can't comment on sort of how it's going overall, but I know people are really trying.
Yeah. And what's OEF?
Sorry, Operation Enduring Freedom. That's what we call Afghanistan.
Okay, gotcha. In Afghanistan and in Iraq, how many mental health professionals are with the troops? I mean, what's the breakout proportionally?
I would love to be able to say I can comment on the Army. I just can't. They certainly have a lot more than we do. When I was out there, I believe there were 9 mental health docs, and then their enlisted counterparts. There were more of them. That were with the Marines in our, we had sort of Western Iraq when I was out there. And it was a relatively sufficient number. I mean, we were very busy, the four of us that took care of our little part of Iraq. We were very, very busy, but I didn't ever feel like, gosh, I wish there were 5 more of me. I felt like we could handle it. Of course, it's always good to have lots of people. but the Army has more, so I can't comment on those numbers. I'm sorry.
Yeah. How long had you been a psychologist before being deployed, and were you prepared? What kind of preparation did you have going in?
I guess I had been a psychologist for 8 years and had certainly studied trauma and its effects and treatment interventions and that sort of thing. I sort of got a crash course from one of my mentors that tried to get me up to speed right before I left. But interestingly, I sort of found that everything was different than I thought it would be once we were out there. And I had to kind of throw away any manuals that I would have thought would have come with me at that point and just trust my instinct as a psychologist, as a person, and as a person that was sharing some of the same trauma that my patients were experiencing. So really quite a unique situation. But I think hopefully lessons learned from our experience. We were really the first ones out there after the push to Baghdad. We were the first ones that had set up in sort of the current mission as it stands. So I think some of our lessons learned have been passed on to our colleagues, and they do feel like they've got a nice knowledge base now of what's been working and what hasn't worked, the things to take with them, the important things to consider, etc. So I hope we're learning as we go. We're a learning organization.
Yeah. It's got to be a tall order, given that we're seeing so many soldiers deployed more than once, multiple deployments.
Right. Absolutely. And certainly the cumulative effects of deployment are not yet known. But we know that that's something that we're keeping an eye on, is when people have been multiple deployers, certainly that puts them at higher risk for experiencing trauma in one or more of those experiences. So we definitely watch them.
Yeah, and I wonder how many soldiers are being redeployed with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, I can't comment on that, but I can say that we do our best as providers, and I'm speaking for taking care of active duty Marines. I do my best. If I've got a guy with post-traumatic stress disorder that I am treating that I feel is not yet deployable, I have him on a status called limited duty where he is not deployable during the time that I'm treating him. And I can hope that all providers of active duty warfighters are doing the same thing, that these guys who are coming forward for treatment, and of course that's the big if, isn't it, that they come forward in the first place. But if they are coming forward for treatment, we are keeping them away from the deployment situation while they're being treated until they are completely functional and symptom-free again.
Yeah. How many women soldiers, how many women suffer PTSD?
There's data just sort of now starting to come in from this. Women have always been a high number of sort of trauma survivors and PTSD in general, because a lot of the data we have on PTSD is from rape. I know that this is something the military is paying close attention to, is sort of this idea of women who might have a past history of sexual trauma and then go out into combat, or this sort of double trauma experience for female service members. When we were in Iraq, we had very few women out there with us, so I personally only took care of a couple. And currently I don't have any... No, I take that back. One woman. I'm taking care of one woman at the moment. But certainly they're still in the minority of the overall numbers, so I imagine we'll get rates after these numbers start to sift out a bit and we have better data.
How do you help someone suffering post-traumatic stress disorder?
There are a number of treatments that are available to providers now. One which is very strongly evidence-based and has lots of years of proof that it works, among others that are also developing and data is being gathered as we speak. I use a technique called prolonged exposure where the patient is actually in an environment where he or she feels safe. They're using imaginal exposure to, in a safe place, relive the trauma with a therapist in the first person in the present tense again and again and again. And as that person does that, they begin to take control of the memory, vice the other way around, so that they are able to let go of the anxiety that has been thus far associated with that memory. The more you expose yourself to it, the more the anxiety releases. And it's a relatively short-term cognitive behavioral treatment that has had very, very promising results with our combat vets, and we really feel pretty comfortable recommending it. The antidepressants are also used, the SSRIs, like Lexapro, Celexa, Paxil, those types of meds, to take the edge off of some of the symptoms while the people are in treatment. It seems to help quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. And do you suggest that they keep a journal, that they write about their experiences?
Some of my patients prefer the writing. There's two different ways to do it. You can do it speaking or writing. Some people have a harder time verbalizing their experiences, or for a variety of different reasons can't do that. So, yeah, I have several guys that are using the writing technique. They write about the experience or the memory. They come in, they read it to me, and so we go through it that way. So, yeah, I mean, certainly that was my trauma treatment, was to write. So I am very supportive of patients that want to do it that way.
Yeah. Had you kept a journal prior to your deployment?
In some cases, at certain different times of my life. I think when I was in flight surgeon school, I thought that would be a fun time to have a journal. So, you know, sort of different periods that were interested. I was doing some travel to Africa several years before and kept a journal of that. It hasn't been an ongoing thing, but it's been sort of during episodic times that were interesting.
Yeah. What was it like at the end of the day after some of the things that, you know, like you've seen and you've been through and you've done so much comforting? What's it like then to try and put that into words?
My journal, I have both of them with me, and they are just completely illegible and very difficult to understand. Many times we were writing, I had this little headlamp, you know, and I was in the dark, and I was trying to write with my headlamp, so it's just really a mess. But it was also a mess because of exactly what you're talking about. I think I was just so exhausted.
Yeah.
I remember that sort of this overall feeling of we didn't sleep very well out there. It was really hot, and for a long time we didn't have power to our barracks, so we were in these concrete buildings, but there was no moving air. So I think we just, between that and the helicopters coming in and always sort of worrying about any helicopter that went over being one that had casualties in it, we didn't sleep very much. So I think I did the best I could. I figured out a way. I just wrote because I knew I would want to have it someday. I forced myself to write, even if I was so tired.
Yeah. Being so tired, one wonders, you know, how you get through the day. Was that tough, or was it just a lot of adrenaline fed?
Yeah, I guess adrenaline was part of it. I think we also just adapted. We adapted to so many different things, but I think we adapted to the amount of sleep we were getting, too. I don't remember ever feeling like I wasn't able to focus on my patients, like I was going to fall asleep. It was never like that. It was sort of more of this chronicity that just, I think we just adapted to it. We worked out every morning. We would go to the gym and work out really hard, and I think that was a really good start.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of kept us going for a large part of the day, and that was a big thing for me.
Yeah. What was daily routine like on the base when things, was it ever quiet?
Yes, it had its lulls, and we would go days sometimes with nothing going on at all. So in those cases, my partner and I and our two psychiatric technicians had an outpatient clinic where we just had people coming in for more routine things, kind of the more chronic mental health care, and we took care of people in a clinic setting, sort of. And that was every day. We did that every day. We would rotate who was on duty or who took care of emergencies. But otherwise, we saw our patients most days of the week. We'd go to a meeting in the morning, rounds, sort of see what had happened over the night, who was on the ward. It was kind of a typical hospital-type setting. And then go get breakfast. And, of course, this was after working out at 4:30. We worked out at 4:30 because that was the only time it was cool enough to get to the gym. So the morning started quite early. And then we would start seeing patients around 8 and go get lunch and usually end around dinner time. There was some time in the evenings when we could watch movies. My little group of guys, we all pitched in and bought all the seasons of The Sopranos, and we spread them out over the 7 months and watched them twice a week, and they were really something to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you figure out a way.
Yeah. After a day where all hell had broken loose, what was the worst day during your deployment? Hard to pick.
There were several. I think there were several days where two different things were going on at once with regard to what you might think of a worst day. We did take a fair amount of incoming artillery. They shot rockets at us from a long ways away, and so when rockets were coming in and things were exploding, and then casualties came on top of that, those were the worst days because it just felt so chaotic. As providers, our hands were tied. We had to stay where we were until we had been given the all clear to be able to come to the hospital, but we knew the casualties were coming. And I think those were the days when it felt there was a sense of helplessness as doctors, nurses, and healers that we were, our hands were being tied by the fact that someone was trying to kill us at the same time we were trying to save others. So I think that's what I meant by sort of the same trauma as our patients. In some cases, that was the case, that we were trying to operate and take care of people and do therapy and provide comfort while windows were exploding because rockets were coming around us. So those were the days I remember as that feeling of chaos, but that was also the real adrenaline, you know, so that those were the nights we stayed up all night, couldn't fall asleep.
And to what extent did you take care of one another? Did you look out for one another's mental situation, what was going on?
I felt like that was one of my jobs, to be honest with you. I felt like I was very in tune to that. I was roommates with two of our nurses, and I do feel like that was part of what I did for them. Not under the guise of being a therapist, but just being a friend. But I listened a lot, and to many of our corpsmen and to our surgeons and anesthesiologists, people who struggled with different things. You know, American doctors just are not used to the feeling of helplessness, of losing someone on the table that they feel like they should be able to save. And that takes its toll. So that was one of my jobs. I really did believe that.
Dr. Heidi Squire-Kraft is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We have about 10 minutes remaining. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join our discussion with a question, a comment for Dr. Heidi Squire-Kraft. She is a veteran of Iraq. She spent 9 years as a psychologist in the Navy. She is the author of Rule Number 2, Lessons I Learned in a Combat Hospital. The title, Rule Number 2, is inspired by the television show MASH. There are two rules of war. Rule Number 1 is that young men die. Rule Number 2 is that doctors can't change Rule Number 1. By the way, 10% of the royalties our guest, Dr. Kraft, receives from sales of the book are being donated to the Injured Marine Semper Fi Fund. And for more information about our guest and her book, Rule Number 2, you may want to visit the website, rulenumber2.com. What were your thoughts about your children while you were in Iraq? They were 15 months old when you left, the twins,
right.
Brian and Megan.
Right. You know, I had this delusion when I left that I was going to be able to continue as I had before, which was sort of half doctor, half mother, half wife, half friend, you know, sort of what I needed to be to everybody. Once I got out there, I realized that that was not going to be possible. And most of that was because of what we were just talking about, these days when our own lives were also in danger, as well as those of our patients. It was the first time that we took rocket fire, and that feeling of dread, the idea that I might never see them again, hit me like a ton of bricks that night, that it was entirely possible that I would not make it out of this experience alive. And it was the first time that had hit me so hard. And I realized that I was not going to be able to split my roles in the desert. I was going to have to be one or the other. So I decided I really didn't have a choice as to which that was going to be. I took all their pictures and put them away. And I compartmentalized, we call it that, in the military, where you sort of take one part of your life and put it in a box and move it away. I had to do that. I would not have been functional for my patients if I hadn't.
Yeah. But then out of the box, with calls home.
Right. I tried to find a way to kind of scoot back into the box at the time I needed to. This was very difficult to do, by the way. And I'm realizing that now, that, you know, denial works really well as an adaptive mechanism when you need it. The problem is it works too well. You know, it's hard to reconnect when you have to. So that those calls home were many times very painful. I had a hard time connecting on the way that I needed to be, and the feeling that I couldn't do anything to help when my children were sick, when it was difficult at home. I was helpless to help, and it was just really difficult for me to put all those, get those things in perspective. So very painful. I called home about once a week and checked email every couple days and tried to stay up with it, but I gave myself very distinct windows. windows, and then I put it back away.
Yeah. And how did Mike fare?
Oh, he did beautifully.
Yeah.
It was difficult, of course, but he did beautifully. I think as a Marine, he knew too much. You know, he knew that, I think, as opposed to many spouses, he actually knew what was going on and how much fire we were actually taking and how dangerous it actually was. He and my dad, they both knew. Yeah. I don't think my mom, she might not have known, but he and my dad knew. And I think he did the same thing. You know, he's a pilot by trade, and he had to do the same thing when he flew. He put things in his box and put them away. And so he took the danger to my life and put it in a box. you know, I think we both just, we put our blinders on. We had to. But the children did beautifully, and it's because they were so loved. There was no question that they were just so loved by so many people.
Yeah.
So they did fine. They have no memory of it. They have seen pictures, but they have no memory of it.
Yeah. What was it like that homecoming day? You write in rule number two, I moved trance-like through the wonderful party, and you were just stunned by all the stimulation.
Right.
But there they are, these two beautiful children and your husband. And
right. Yeah, coming home is shocking. Everything moves really fast, and everything's colorful, and it smells good. It's just like this over, your sensory input is overloaded. But the day that I stepped off the plane, they were just under two when I got home, and he came running and yelled mommy and jumped in my arms, and it was fabulous. It was wonderful. That being said, it still took me a while to get back to feel like I belonged with them again.
Yeah.
Long haul.
How did your husband and your parents talk with those little people about where mommy was?
I think they said mommy is in the desert. My children remember mommy being in the desert. That's the way they think of it. Mommy's in the desert. That's why she's wearing that tan outfit. she's helping people. You know, she's out there to help people. They had pictures that they showed them, and there was a chaplain on our base that did a cool thing where parents could come and read a book, a child's book, and he would videotape it and then send the videotapes home. So we did that a couple times where they received videotapes of me reading books to them. So they had some images of me. I wasn't a completely foreign face, but I just think they were too young to get it at all. You know, I think it was just, in some ways, the best possible age for a mother to deploy, because the children really didn't get it. So that was sort of a relief, I think, to everybody involved.
It was a surprise to me to learn that it was tough for you the first day back on the job, and for probably some time back on the job.
Mm-hmm. It was. You know, psychology is, everything's so relative. People's problems are so relative, and they really are on a continuum, and every problem is real because it is a problem for a person. But coming from that situation where problems were defined in such a different spectrum, and a problem for my patients in Iraq was losing their best friend and dealing with that grief and shame and guilt and dread and trauma, you know, what I heard from my patients upon return to a base that didn't have Marines. We didn't have people deploying to Iraq. We had ships and squadrons, Navy people, who deployed, but not to combat at the moment. That's changed a little bit. But so the what people came with was just out of my realm of being able to to put it in perspective. I really struggled with that for a while. I really, really did not have a lot of, in the way of empathy for a while. I don't think I was a very good psychologist for those first couple months.
You had a conversation with a technician, a psychiatric technician, who you call HM3 Betancourt, and it was 10 minutes, and you said very few words were spoken. And I'm wondering if part of the process of healing is just being there with someone. And on the cover of the book, there's a touching photo of, you know, soldier to soldier.
Yeah.
Nothing being said.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting. The cover of the book is illustrative of one of the chapters in which I broke one of my own rules of actually touching a patient's hands. I don't typically touch my patients. It's sort of inappropriate for a psychologist to do. But in this case, this patient was experiencing so much grief and so much trauma, and there was nothing that I could say that would be right. So I just put my hand on top of his, and he looked at me and realized that I got it. And as you say, just that moment of being in it with him seemed to be healing and therapeutic in and of itself. Then my own experience with sort of a panic attack upon coming home and realizing I had to start seeing patients again. My psych tech, this junior, wonderful technician who had been with the Marines and deployed, came in, closed the door, sat with me, and told me, it's okay if you're not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very, very powerful. And that is his real name. And I hope he's out there doing great things, because that was very insightful and true.
Yeah. Well, your patients are very fortunate people, Dr. Kraft.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that.
I want to thank you very much for being with us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
The pleasure has been mine. Thank you very much for having me on.
Dr. Heidi Squire Kraft has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Rule Number 2, Lessons I Learned in a Combat Hospital. The publisher is Little Brown.